So thanks. I would like to thank the organizers of this workshop. It's really great to hear about these connections between what we do in quantum information theory from this community and what of the things we develop there can maybe potentially have a use in quantum chemistry. So I enjoyed it a lot until now. And I would like now to tell you something about the application of Definetti theorem. So you have heard in the talks yesterday by Robert Koenig and Graham Mitchison what Definetti theorems are and what versions we have. And the talk today will, in the first part, focus on just the original motivation of why we need Definetti-type theorems. And then in the second part, I will be a little bit more specific and show how they can be used to estimate entropies, which is actually an application, or which is actually useful for an application for applications in quantum cryptography. So we'll start with this first part, which is, as I said, the original motivation. And to give you this original motivation for Definetti theorems, it's actually useful to go back almost 100 years, actually only 70 years, to Definetti's original work, which was kind of purely classical. So he was looking at classical probability distributions and classical random variables. And so, let me start with that. So what the problem he was concerned about is kind of what can we say if it takes statistics. So in a language of physicists, I mean, he was not a physicist, but a mathematician, but as a physicist, I would phrase the problem he was looking at in the following way. So assume we have a physical experiment, and the experiment could be anything, like, for example, a particle collider that produces, for example, some particles. And so it could be that we see in this experiment some new type of particles that are generated. And I draw here a sequence of particles to indicate that we can, of course, repeat an experiment and produce many of these new type of particles that we have detected here or are going to detect. And now the obvious question is that we want to see what properties these particles have. And one typical property could be, for example, the decay time. So we could realize that these particles decay after a short time, and we would like to measure the time it takes for them to decay, the half-life, so to speak. So what do we do? Of course, what we do, we just trap these particles and measure the time until they decay. But in order to do that, I mean, as you know, there is kind of an exponential law of when they decay, and if you do it just for one particle, we'll not be able to say much about the decay time of this new species of particles that you have discovered. So what one is typically doing is to repeat this experiment and to measure the decay time of many particles, and then from that conclude the typical half-life of such a particle. So if you're doing that, however, we are making implicitly at least an assumption. And the assumption is that the decay time of each of these particles, or that the decay, the actual decay time, not the average one, but the actual one when it decays, is independent for each one. So we kind of assume that there's no kind of correlation. For example, I mean, of course, one could imagine that there's a correlation in such a way that two particles that are produced subsequently will have the property that only one of them decays immediately and the other one will wait for a long time, or vice versa. Or it could be that two are correlated and always decay at the same time. Or it could be arbitrary correlations in principle. And of course, as a physicist, usually assume that this things don't happen. However, the question is, why are we actually so sure that there are no correlations? Because this is maybe one big experiment, like a particle collider, and produces all these things, and there is no really physical reason to assume that the things we produce are independent of each other. And so here is where Definetti's results become useful. So what he actually did is to reduce this assumption that these things are all independent of each other to an assumption that we can actually verify or even enforce. So I should note here that it's in principle impossible to verify experimentally whether there is a correlation between such particles. So if there is a correlation, we may be lucky and detect that. But we will never be able to actually do sufficiently many experiments to be sure that there is no correlation, because there could be correlation that we only see if we test at least k particles for some large number k. And so for any finite number of experiments we do, there's always the possibility that we miss something. It's also clear that if I give you just a bunch of n particles and you have to see whether the decay times are correlated, you would have to repeat this whole experiment with all the n particles many times. So it needs n to the k, or many times n particles. So it's just kind of impossible. So the point is, the assumption that these things are independent is not a verifiable, at least not experimentally verifiable assumption. So now, what De Finetti essentially did is to do the following. I mean, very roughly speaking, he said that if we only know that there is some symmetry, namely permutation symmetry, and we'll just come back to the reason why we are actually happy to make such an assumption, then we have what I would just roughly say call independence. So that is roughly speaking his theorems. You have seen more mathematical versions of that yesterday. I will also, of course, write it down in the next few minutes, but this is just the idea. So the idea is that we replace this thing that we cannot verify. So I should just write it. So this is not verifiable experimentally by something that is actually natural. And I would say here, this we can even either say it's natural, or we can actually, if you don't believe that it's natural, kind of enforce it. So what do I mean by enforce it? We can just kind of, if we produce these particles, mix them in some way. So before we do any further experiment, we just apply random permutations to all the particles we produce. We could do that in principle, of course. I mean, you never do that in a natural experiment, but in principle we could do that. And then, by definition, if you do a random permutation, what comes out is a permutation invariant state. So we can kind of, at least in principle, make the overall state describing the joint behavior of all these particles permutation invariant. Yes?
You can enforce independence the same way by sampling with replacement from the ensemble that you have.
What do you mean by sample with replacement?
So you take, say, you pick one of your systems and then you experiment, and presuming it doesn't destroy the system, you then put it back in and sample another one possibly.
This, I would say this would just enforce symmetry. So because, I mean, there is... So this is kind of the idea, maybe why the theorem holds. But it's, for example, not true for. I mean, you will just see that this is generally not true. So I could give you, and will give you later examples, where when you do exactly what you described, you will have this, but not that thing here. So essentially, what you said is just the intuition behind the theorem, which is in most cases true, but not always. And so, of course, because of the theorem, I mean, as I just said, if you can enforce that, and because this implies this, we can eventually enforce this thing here. But there is some catch here. So this doesn't hold, so I should maybe put something like an approximation. So this is not perfectly true, and there will be some parameters that come in. But the point is that what De Finetti said is that we can actually make this assumption of independence safely. And it's kind of, I think his result is kind of really important, at least for, paranoid people in some way. So one could imagine that physics is kind of malicious and tries to cheat us and behave in a way we don't expect. And what De Finetti says is that, no, this is not the case. This cannot be the case. We can actually do physics even if nature was malicious. So it's kind of a theorem that allows us to do physics the way we intuitively think about it, that we can do something, we observe something, and from what we observe, we are kind of convinced that the properties we see at certain positions will also be the properties that we would expect for other particles at the same time. So in some way, if you measure the mass of an electron here in the lab, then the electrons outside the lab will have the same mass. This is something you always assume, but it's actually based on this thing here. Okay, so this was just the original motivation, and I would like now to go a little bit more into detail. So yesterday we have already seen some versions of De Finetti's theorem, and let me quickly summarize two of them. So, as I said, this is only approximately true, and the approximation is kind of in the following sense. And I write it now immediately down in the quantum language, and Definetti's original theorems were kind of exactly the same, except that you just have to replace all density operators by probability distributions. So one of the theorems is the following. So you have a state, rho k, so this should be a state on an k-fold product space. And what he wants to say is to measure the distance of the state to actually kind of a state of identically distributed particles. So this is a sigma. So sigma is on one single subspace. And there is an integral which just indicates that this is kind of, I mean, one interpretation of this is that this is kind of an unknown state. So if you have to write down the state of this joint system, and you know that they're all in identical states and independent of each other, you would actually write down the thing without an integral if you knew what the state of the individual subsystem is. But if you don't know what the state of the individual subsystem is, you have to, in general, write down this integral with some maybe unknown or some distribution over the possible state sigma of one subsystem. So this is, I mean, the interpretation of this is it is actually physically just a state of n independent particles the same in the same state, but you don't know which one. I mean, that's one possible interpretation. And now, one version of Definetti's theorem tells you that this is kind of close, and in the following. So these two things are close in the following sense. So this is k divided by n times d squared, where k is already here. This is kind of just the size. Then n means that the state, so rho k should be n exchangeable, which means that there exists a permutation invariant state rho n on an n-fold subsystem such that rho k is just a trace of this. So I take the trace, I trace out n minus k subsystems of rho n. So in other words, one could again think about this experiment, and n would be kind of the total number of particles that I in principle could produce, and k would be actually a smaller number, which is the number of particles I actually measure or which are relevant for my statement that I want to make. Yes. Yes, thank you. So this is of course a k. So these are equally large systems. Thanks. So and the d is just the dimension of one subsystem. So this is kind of what the theorem tells us. So this is now the more precise statement. And as you can see, if for example that dimension of a particle is larger than n, so you have high dimensional systems, then this statement is trivial. It tells you that it could have distance 1. But the point is that this is in some way tight. So for example, if n is equal to d, you could have the fully antisymmetric state. Now the point is that the statement should apply to the fully antisymmetric state, because if I write the fully antisymmetric state as a density operator, it's again a permutation invariant density operator. But in that case, because this d divided by n will be larger than 1, the distance, this gives no bound. And indeed, if you now look at this reduced state, for even for the kind of almost trivial case where k is 2, so you take out of this many particles just 2 and look at the state of these 2, then you will find that this is kind of a fully entangled state, or it's kind of a mixture of singlet states. So it's far away from a state of that type. It actually has distance 1/2. Yes?
There exists a measure d sigma such that
yes, right. So I should have written. So the Definetti theorem kind of says, thanks for asking that. I should have written that. So for any rule which satisfies this condition. There exists some measure d sigma such that this holds. This is the precise statement. Now it turns out that for applications, which I will talk about in the next part of the talk, this is often not sufficiently good. And the main problem is actually this dependence on k. So if I have an experiment that only produces n particles and I want to make a statement about almost all of them, then k has to be almost equally large as n. And in that case, this quantity is close to 1 or even much larger than 1, which doesn't give me a nice approximation of the state. So it just gives me, in that case, a trivial state. And this, by the way, is the 1 norm. So what one would like to have is something that scales nicely, even in the case where k is just slightly smaller than n. Then I could make a statement about almost all particles here, whereas this statement only allows me to kind of make statements about a small fraction of all particles. But because, as I just said, this is tight, there's no hope to just improve the theorem in the obvious way by replacing this term. But as you have heard yesterday in the in the presentation by Robert Koenig, one can relax this condition here. So in some way, this condition requires that these k particles are all identical. If we now would allow that some of them, let's say k is a little bit larger just for this picture, so we now want to make k actually almost as large as n. But now what we allow is that some particles here are in an arbitrary state that we don't know. So we just relax the condition, rather than requiring that we want to approximate the real state that we have by a perfect product state, we just are happy even if this approximation is just in terms of what I call an almost product state. It's a product state on most subsystems with a few errors, so to speak. And physically, this shouldn't make a difference. So if you think about any application in physics, one would expect that every physically relevant quantity should be robust. So if I'm making any statement about the system, but I just change the state of one particle out of many, or of a few out of many, the physical property of the overall system shouldn't change much. This is kind of the intuition behind why one is happy to replace this. And so what one can now do is to do something that is sometimes called an exponential Definetti theorem. And here the statement is almost the same, except that I just replace, so let me call this the distance, delta, and this is the state I want to approximate. So this thing here, what I have here, or maybe even only the thing here in the middle, so this sigma tensor k is now replaced by, maybe I should use the right thing, a state of the form sigma tensor k minus r tensor some arbitrary state rho tilde r and permutations thereof. So in some way, what I mean, this is not the mathematically precise statement, but this is kind of the intuition, because one actually also allows superpositions of such things. But let's for the moment, for simplicity, ignore them. So the idea is that I replace this perfect product state by something where I have R subsystems that have errors, so to speak. And the idea is that R is much smaller than K. So I have a small number of errors that I kind of tolerate. And then, in addition, I can replace, and that was, of course, the goal, also the delta. So the delta is now going to be much smaller. The delta will now be equal to something like exponential in k and r, and then divided by n. And then there is some dependency on the dimension, which I don't specify here. So let's assume for a moment that the dimension is fixed. And then the delta will go to zero pretty fast if, oh, sorry, here was a mistake. So this is n minus k and r divided by n. So to see how this scales, let's, for example, choose n minus k scale. I mean, n minus k is actually the number of systems that I don't consider. This is in this case. So this should be small. And let's make that scale like the third root, for example. I mean, this is just an example now to illustrate what the theorem tells us. So let's assume this is something like the third root of n. So we just want to ignore an asymptotically vanishing fraction of the systems. And let's also say that the number of errors we tolerate should scale like the third root of n. And then, that's a mistake again. So I wanted to have I could have written it as third root of the n squared. So this would be the scaling. And then if I insert that in the above, then I get a delta which scales roughly like n to the minus n to the 1/3. So I still have an exponential scaling in n. So the error that I make in my approximation goes to zero exponentially fast. And this was just because I tolerated these few error positions. Okay. So this is kind of a short summary of the theorems that exist. And so what one can conclude from them is that it is really possible to, in practical situations, to assume that what I generate by an experiment has this nice structure up to some small number of errors. That's kind of the message of this first part. Now I would like to talk about a more specific application, which is in the area of information theory. So in information theory, we are often interested in just quantitative characterizations of certain tasks. So just to give you an idea of what I'd like to do now. So this is now application. Maybe we should first ask, are there questions related to this general part? And this should just, this is kind of a summary of work that has been done, and maybe I should also mention that many of these statements have been generalized, in particular by Graham and Robert and other people that were mentioned in Robert's talk yesterday. But are there questions about that thing? Okay, so then I will quickly talk about application information theory. And for that, I should just quickly say what are people often doing in information theory? And one of the things one is typically interested in is to characterize certain things. For example, one has a noisy channel, and one wants to characterize how much information that I can transmit through the noisy channel. Or another problem, which is very basic, even in classical information theory, I should write that down, typical problems are like, I have information or some data X, and the question is, what is the amount of memory that I need to store it? This is also known as the compression problem. So what is the size of a memory, or the memory size needed to store it? If I compress the value x in an optimal way. So this is often known as compression. And another problem is, for example, randomness extraction. This is actually important for cryptography. So here the problem is, again, I have data x. And what is... So what is the amount of uniform randomness that can be extracted from X? And what does that mean, to extract randomness? It just means that if I'm just allowed to do deterministic operations, and I have some random value which is not necessarily uniformly distributed, then the question, I mean, maybe I have a picture, I have this x, I have some x, and this is not necessarily uniform. And the question is, I want to generate some uniform bits. Let's call them R, some randomness, and they should be uniform. But I'm only applied to do something deterministic, so I kind of apply a function to X. So R is just a function of X. And the question is, what is the maximum size of uniform randomness or number of bits? What is the maximum number of uniform bits that I can get from X? And this is actually one of the main problems in cryptography, because in as a remark, this is important, or I would even say this is kind of the crucial problem one has to solve if one analyzes quantum key distribution. Namely there, one looks at a value conditioned on the information that an adversary can have. So in that case, one has here, for example, Alice and Bob, and they communicate over some quantum channel and perform a quantum key distribution protocol. And the first phase of a quantum key distribution protocol usually just consists of exchanging certain particles like photons and measuring them, and then you get some outcomes. And on Alice's side, this could be an outcome X, and on Bob's side, something else, X prime. And now, typically, if there is an adversary here on the line, the adversary will have some information about X. And so the main principle behind quantum cryptography is that Alice and Bob try to detect whether there is an adversary in the line. If they realize that they have too many errors between X and X prime, they will just abort the protocol and say that, and conclude that they can actually not generate the secret key. If the disturbances they measure between X and X prime are sufficiently small, they would say that, okay, in that case, it is impossible for an adversary to have measured too much of the data that have been transmitted, and so her information will be relatively small, which means that conditioned on the knowledge of an adversary, this X has a lot of entropy or randomness in it. However, it could still be non-uniform. It could be that, for example, the adversary knows some bits of this X or some parts of it, and that could happen even if Alice and Bob don't see any disturbances. So the usual problem in quantum key distribution is to transform this into something that is, at least from the adversary's point of view, completely uniform. And that is then the kind of secret key they want to generate. So in some way, one can split the quantum key distribution protocol in one part. In the first part, they just try to generate some randomness, which is not necessarily very good. And in the second part, which is usually called privacy amplification, they generate uniform randomness from the partially secret randomness they have here. And the question is now, how do we have to measure the randomness here in this random variable X in order to be sure that this privacy amplification works? And so that's why it's important to know how much randomness we can extract. And the answers to these problems have actually been known for a long time. And according to Shannon, and later in quantum information, according to Schumacher, here the answer would just be, it's the entropy of X. And the same is actually true here. So in some way, the memory needed to store a random value is just its entropy. In the classical case, it's the Shannon entropy, the quantum case, the von Neumann entropy. The same is true for this randomness extraction. So if you have an entropy of it, a certain entropy, then this entropy corresponds asymptotically to the number of bits we can extract. There's, however, again, a catch with that, and it's the same thing as what we have seen here previously, that we have this hidden assumption that all these things are independent. So essentially the whole theory of Shannon, and also a large part of quantum information theory, is kind of based on the assumption that data we have is available in an IID form, which means that we have many independent copies of the same data, and when we are asking how much storage we need, we are actually asking how much space do we need per realization of a random variable X, under the assumption that we have many copies of X and want to store all of them. Yes? Yes, sir?
Yes, so this can,
it's often IID, and it can be relaxed to stationary sources, for example. But you still, in some way, have strong requirements on the kind of structure of the source in some way. So it is true. So what I wrote here is kind of the special case of IID, but I would claim that we are still, even the generalizations that are known within Shannon theory are rather special in some way. But there is actually, so this is kind of under the, again, the, what I before called the independence assumption and asymptotically. But one can actually generalize all these results to a situation where no assumptions have to be made whatsoever. So we can just really ask the question, what, how much storage do we need if you have just one realization of a random variable which you want to store? Or here in that problem, how much randomness can we extract if you just have one random variable x? And this one could, of course, still be many, but finitely many. So here we just don't need any assumption. In that case, one finds here other results, which actually you just replace the entropy by another entropy measure, which in that case is called sometimes a max entropy, and in that case it's the mean entropy. This is kind of the general case. I'll just give you the definition of that in a moment. So in some way, the point is we can generalize the known results in information theory to the which are mostly making certain assumptions, like independence, to the fully general case if we replace the entropy measures by more general entropy measures. And one could now actually continue this table I made here to many other problems like channel coding, and what you will see is that on the left-hand side of this table we'll always find expressions that are in terms of Shannon or von Neumann entropy. On the right-hand side we will also only have expression in terms of this max entropy and the mean entropy. So while in the kind of independent case you have one entropy measure, there are actually two in the general case, but not more. This is actually remarkable. One could imagine that in the general case, there are infinitely many entropy measures for each problem. I need a different one, but this is not the case. Moreover, these two measures are actually related to each other. One can express this one in terms of this and vice versa, but I will not point to that. But I will quickly give you the definition of it.
What exactly do you mean by general case? Do you mean there are some correlations? Or?
There may be arbitrary correlations. So you just have, you just look at your data as one big random. It could be that you have a finite number of data points, like you have 10 realizations, you have a source giving you 10 x's, but they could be arbitrarily correlated. So you just take the joint distribution of that and compute the entropy of that. And yeah, that will give you the answer to that problem. So how is this, just for those who are interested, what is actually the definition of this entropy? So, so in the general case, one defines in contrast to how one defines von Neumann entropy, directly a conditional version of it. So one cannot write the conditional entropy in terms of the non-conditional one. So if I have a state rho and I want to define this mean entropy, then so this mean entropy is defined as the maximum over all lambda such that rho AB is smaller or equal to 2 minus lambda times an identity over A tensor sigma B. So, I mean, where sigma b is just an arbitrary density operator. So you maximize over all of them and look at this. So this is just a definition that may not be that intuitive if you see it for the first time. I just want to make clear that the definition looks very different to the usual definition you maybe have in mind when you think about Shannon entropy or von Neumann entropy. And so I didn't put an epsilon here. And this epsilon is an additional parameter which just comes in because if, I mean, while Shannon entropy is usually giving us asymptotic statements, whenever we are looking at the finite correlation, we will have non-asymptotic statements, which means that we have to tolerate some finite error probability, and this is this epsilon that comes in here. And this is just defined as the maximum over all mean entropies, where I maximize over all states in a neighborhood of B epsilon rho. And I just want to make two remarks, which, I mean, Matthias kind of encouraged me to make them remarks because they could be interesting. One of them is that these entropies have a very natural behavior. They behave in the way as you would expect from entropies. One of them is, for example, what I sometimes call superadditivity, but it's of course not, I mean, you will just see the reason why I call it like that. Namely, I mean, the reason will be that the superadditivity for Neumann entropy is a special case of what I show now. So the point is that this mean entropy has the property that it only decreases if I condition on an additional system. So this is a very natural property, which of course you would expect. So if you interpret the entropy as the amount of uncertainty conditioned on knowledge of this thing, so it's uncertainty about A when you know B and C, then of course if you know less, your uncertainty is bigger. This is very natural. And the proof of that is actually almost trivial. So the proof of that is, let lambda be just this kind of entropy. So let lambda be H min epsilon of A given B C. Then by definition, I have this property that rho A B C is smaller or equal to 2 to the minus lambda times the identity on A tensor sigma B C. Now we take the partial trace on both over, so now we take the partial trace over C, which gives me rho AB is smaller or equal to 2 to the minus lambda of IBA tensor sigma C, sigma B. And now, if you go back to the definition, you will see that because the definition maximizes over all lambda, and because this is one possible lambda that fulfills this condition, the mean entropy of A given B can only be larger than the lambda I have here. So this kind of proves this thing that I call superadditivity. Now something that is important to know is that, of course, one would expect that this thing is related to that because this is kind of a special case of the general case, obviously. So how does this relation work? And this is now where the definitive will finally come in later, but we'll already see it here when I make this statement. So there's a statement called, I mean, it's well known in classical information theory. It's just a statement called the asymptotic equipartition property, which essentially is equivalent to the following thing. So this is what they call AEP, asymptotic equipartition property. And it says the following. It gives you a relation between these entropies. So it tells you that the Shannon or von Neumann entropy of A given B of some state sigma is equal to the asymptotically equal to the following. If I let the epsilon go to zero and the n go to infinity, and then I evaluate the mean entropy for A given B for n positions for an IID state, which is created from just taking the sigma, then I have this equality. So in other words, for IID states, this entropy is This entropy is asymptotically equal to this, which has to be the case because, I mean, of course, this has to converge to that if I'm saying that this gives you the general answer. And an important remark is that combining this with this gives you a very simple proof of the strong superadditivity, because if I now take this and evaluate it for an IID state, I mean, I could now evaluate it for sigma tensor n, and of course it's true for any state, in particular for IID state, this thing here implies, so this and this directly implies that H A given B has B C is smaller or equal to H given A given B. So this is strong superadditivity. So going to a more general entropy measure, you find a very simple way of seeing why strong superadditivity has to be true in some way. Now, why? What's the connection again to definition? So the problem is that if we are in the general case, and in quantum key distribution, we are typically in the general case, because there is no reason to assume that an adversary is nice and behaves in an IID way. So if you again think about quantum key distribution, a sender Alice sends information to Bob, but each time she sends a bit of information, the adversary could act in a completely different way and maybe even correlate subsequent signals. So in quantum key distribution, we are in this case. And the question is now, in order to find the rate or to show that we can extract the key, as I explained before, we have to know that this entropy is large because this entropy tells us how much key we can extract by privacy amplification. So the question is, and this is really, I would say, the main challenge if you do a security proof in quantum key distribution, is just to calculate this quantity for the information that Alice and Pope have exchanged. So how do you calculate this quantity? Because this is just an operator inequality, but the state that comes in is just a joint state of all subsystems, which is unknown. Now the way to do it is to actually use this relation and realize that if the state is symmetric, then we are exactly in this situation because of Definetti's theorem. So Definetti's theorem tells us that if we are in a symmetric situation, which again we can enforce for the reasons I said before, we can just randomly permute things. So if you're in this symmetric situation, then approximately we have such a state. And again, we are in a robust situation. Even if I write here a state which is almost of this form with a few errors, the asymptotic theory is still correct. So for a general symmetric state, this is still true. So this is kind of what Definetti tells us. So Definetti implies that this inequality here is true for any symmetric state. One has to be a little bit careful what it actually means, what I have to write on the left-hand side. But one can do it because one just has to minimize over all states here that are kind of possible in possible decomposition. So, but this is kind of the main point. So because we have Definetti, we have a relation which reduces this object, which is extremely difficult to calculate for general states, to an object which only involves the density operator on one subsystem, and therefore is very easy to calculate. And this is kind of actually the surprising thing. And you also see that it's kind of needed in some way. So if we just knew that the state of one subsystem was sigma, but we didn't know that the individual systems are independent of each other, then it could be that, for example, I have in the first subsystem a uniform bit 0 or 1, and the next one could just be a copy of the first, but if I only look at that, it would also be a uniform bit. So it's very important that things are independent, and only then the entropy will add up. So the Definetti theorem is essentially a way to estimate entropies. So we can, this is kind of the claim which I also want to conclude. So using this theorem together with Definetti, we can in general estimate entropies and in fact the kind of relevant entropic quantities. So I couldn't use this because this already inherently assumes that I have a certain structure. So I first go to this more general quantity and then use Definetti to go back and say actually the state is so nice that I'm again back in this special situation. So Definetti kind of gives the justification why the whole theory for that we actually use, or that, for example, you read, if you read a standard textbook like Nielsen and Huang, that this theory is kind of actually more general than one would first think. It doesn't only apply to ID states, but it applies to any symmetric state in some way. And I would like to conclude with that. Thank you.